Well, good morning. It's good to be here at the end of Ruth with you. My name's Gabe. I get the pleasure of serving here at some of you as one of the pastors, and we happen to be the very end of Ruth, closing up this story of finding refuge, redemption, salvation, rescue under the wings of God. I want to jump right into our story. And so I want to catch you up on what has happened in chapters 1 through 3. In chapter 1, Naomi confesses the biggest confession at the beginning of the book that we can't miss, that she comes back to her hometown of Bethlehem after being in the foreign land and says, God has brought me back empty-handed. I don't have my husband. My two sons are dead. I have nothing. And she makes this theological statement. You know, we make theological statements, our beliefs about God all the time. And she says, God is against me. And that's chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, it goes on to find out that she didn't come back empty-handed. She actually came back with her Moabite daughter-in-law. Even though she tried to shake her off of her garment, Ruth clung to her and wouldn't let go. And so she came to the land of Israel, this foreigner. And what she does is she riskily goes to the field and she gleans. You guys know what gleaning is. We talked about that. I came up with my own illustration of gleaning this week. It's that time that I go to the fridge and I open it up. It's not breakfast, lunch, or dinner. I'm just looking for something. But Ruth went to the field and she looked for what was dropped behind, and she gathered what was dropped behind so that her mother-in-law, who was depressed and sad and herself, could eat. But someone noticed her. It was Boaz. She gleans in Boaz's field, and Boaz notices that she has taken refuge in the God of Israel, his God, and he takes that very seriously. He's very impressed, which leads to chapter 3, where Ruth boldly approaches Boaz after the harvest is all done and the threshing begins. And she says, Boaz, you say that I have taken shelter in God's wings, but you marry me. Let me take shelter under your wings. Will you give me refuge? Because you are a redeemer. And what she meant by that was, you're a close kinsman of my father-in-law, Elimelech. Which means if you marry me, you can literally bring Elimelech's family line back from the dead. His land's about to be lost from the family, which today we can kind of identify with a little bit. If you've ever heard of the family farm and how selling it can be a big deal and really difficult, and there's a lot of shame sometimes on the generation that decides to do that. Well, it was even worse back then. And so the fact that they would lose this land was a big deal. And Ruth says, but Boaz, you're a redeemer. And everything's good. And they're going to go get married. And that's the end of the story. But that's not really true. There's a problem. The problem is this, that God was so clear about these laws of redemption that someone who was in a tough situation like Naomi and Ruth would be helped out by God's grace according to his mercy, providing a redeemer. But the problem was, the laws were so clear, there was a closer redeemer than Boaz. Even though Boaz was impressed, even though Boaz had already been gracious to Ruth and in one sense had given her shelter by being generous with barley and wheat and providing for them, there was a redeemer who could potentially buy the land from Naomi and marry Ruth that might not be as affectionate towards her. And so that's our problem. As we open up chapter 4, that's what's going on. That's the issue that needs to be settled. That's the question in the reader's mind. What's going to happen? What is God going to do? And here's what we see in verses 1 through 4. Verses 1 through 4. If you've got your Ruth Journal Bible, which I love those journal Bibles. I write in my Bible anyways. But here's like a green light to write what you're hearing and what God brings to mind during this message. And when you read through Ruth afterwards, you write and underline and circle in there however you see God speaking to you. Write that down. Well, in verses 1 through 4, you could write this over verses 1 through 4. And I think we have this on the screen. The first redeemer says yes. The first redeemer says yes. It's the first thing we come to in verses 1 through 4. It's a big problem. Boaz meets with this closer kinsman to Elimelech at the city gate, which is where all the elders hung out. That's where business took place. It's the civic center for things to happen. And so Boaz says to the redeemer, hey, Naomi's put this land up for sale, which is new news to us. We didn't know that, but it's kind of assumed. And so he says, buy it. And so redeem it because you're a redeemer. Leviticus 25 talked about this kind of redemption, the buying of the land. Keeping the land and the family was really important. You did not want the governor of Moab coming over to Israel and buying a piece of land right near Bethlehem in the land of Israel. No, you didn't want that. And so you had these redeemers who would buy the land, they were close family members, and they would eventually give it back to the family as their fortune changed. And so Boaz is saying, you're the first person to have the opportunity to do this, but don't loiter, because I'd like to redeem it, I'd like to buy it, so you let me know, you know, paint or get off the ladder, because I, Boaz, want to buy this land, all right? And that's why I'm approaching you first, because you have the first choice here. And so what does the Redeemer say? He says, yes, which is the worst news ever to hear. Yeah, he does want to redeem the land. It seems terrible, but we want Boaz to marry Ruth. And this is terrible news. But Boaz is not just well thought of in Bethlehem. He's also a great thinker because he led with the field and that the land was going to be lost. And so, hey, you know, gain the land, right? You know, it's like the carrot in front of him. Of course he's going to say yes. He leads with the field, but he closes with the liability of marrying Ruth, the Moabite. We've talked about this, the Moabite, right? So just hear, like, anything that's bad that rings in your mind, I want you to infuse in this word Moabite, you know? So it's like, hey, redeem the land. And the guy says, yes. And then Boaz says, and you get to marry Ruth the Moabite as well. He knows this isn't good news to the redeemer. You see, when he buys the field, this redeemer believes that he's gaining property. He's going to pay money from his estate and going to gain this field, and his children are going to inherit Elimelech's field. That's what he's thinking. That's his motive. That's his desire. But marrying Ruth, that's a whole nother level. Because he's going to pay money from his household, his estate, to buy this field. And then he's going to marry Ruth and produce a child that will carry Elimelech's name and not his. And that child eventually will be given this field. And this redeemer is now out all that money that he paid for it. You see, redemption is work. It's sacrifice. And what we see about this redeemer is that he is self-interested. He is not really concerned with redemption. He's concerned with serving himself. He's not thinking, what kindness can I do to my dead relative Elimelech? He's going to lose everything. And so he says no, out of his own self-interest. No, you redeem it. And here's the thought in my mind. Because the redemption laws are so clear in the Old Testament, I wonder why did Naomi walk into Bethlehem thinking, there's no hope for me in Israel. There's no hope for me. When there were such clear redemption laws for people who were in a pickle, who were in a tough position just like she was. I mean, God made it so clear. Why would you doubt that he would redeem you? That he wouldn't change your situation? And it's right here in the story that we get a clue. That God's heart was to redeem Naomi's situation. But Naomi was cynical and didn't believe that anybody in Israel would want to give up what they would need to give up in order to redeem her family. And this first redeemer affirms that. Gaining the land, he's on board. Sacrifice, no way. I'm passing on redemption. That's why Naomi is cynical. She believes everybody will be like this first redeemer. But that leads us to verses 6 through 10. And if you want to write next to verses 6 through 10, so you know what's going on, Boaz redeems Ruth. Boaz redeems Ruth. The second half of verse 9, Boaz says, "You are witnesses this day," which is a key word, witness. If you want to circle a word, it's witness right here. The same phrase is going to be repeated. "You are witnesses this day," Boaz says, "that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, his two sons." Verse 10, "Also Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife for this reason, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." This is what Naomi cannot believe, that God would preserve and put forefront in front of them the first day that Ruth goes to glean, that Boaz, the prime redeemer, would be set up to connect with Ruth. She couldn't envision God raising a prime redeemer who would want to marry her Moabite daughter-in-law and kindly start a family that would bear Elimelech's heritage and receive Elimelech's land that would cost him, that he would have to pay for this. Boaz would have to pay for us. Who would be so gracious and sacrifice so much? Naomi, at the beginning of the story, she cannot believe there is such a redeemer. And yet, in God's purpose, he preserves someone with such honor as Boaz, who would say, "I'm willing to redeem. I want to give up what it costs in order to see Elimelech's family continue, that his name would not be forgotten in our families, in our clan, in our tribe, in our nation, in our land. He will not be forgotten, but that you will be restored." But there's one other problem in this text. There's one other problem. It's this. Ruth is barren. In the next few verses, especially 11 and 12, you could write this, Ruth is barren. It's hinted at in the text. In chapter 1, verse 4, Ruth was married for about 10 years, and she was without a child. You see, no Israelite planned on being married for 10 years and not having a child. It's a sure sign that she was unable to have children. It wasn't like today. But there's a second evidence. The people at the gate say to Boaz, in order to bless his redemption, they say this, second half of verse 11, after they say, "We are witnesses," they say, "May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel." You see, Rachel and Leah did build up the house of Israel. There was no Israelite that didn't know what son of Jacob, so son of Leah or Rachel, they came from, the 12 tribes of Israel. They knew. They were a testimony to this. But here's the truth. Both of these women, Rachel and Leah, who ended up building up this vast nation of Israel, all the sons of Israel or Jacob, both these women struggled with infertility. Rachel was the first. She was the one loved by Jacob, and yet she could not bear him a child. And it was a terrible struggle. And she was insulted and she was shamed by Leah, who Jacob didn't really care for. But yet Leah was able to have children until she wasn't. The one thing she thought she had going for was that she could bear children for Jacob. But then all of a sudden that changed. See, both these women, in their story, there was a struggle of infertility. And so as these people are saying, "We want you to be like Rachel and Leah, Ruth," they're saying, "We want God to redeem the fact that you're unable or have been so far to have a child." That's what they're saying. And then in verse 11, it continues, may you act worthily, Boaz, in Ephrathah, and be renowned in Bethlehem, and may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this woman. Again, another woman who dealt with a problem of not being able to have a child, but it was because she was a widow, just like Ruth. In fact, she was a widow twice over before having a child. The fact that these three women are brought up that are pictures of God's redemption in the story of the people of God are the fact that they are saying, we believe that God's going to redeem your family, Naomi, and do it through Ruth, your daughter-in-law, who so far has been unable to have a child. There's hope. And that leads us to verses 13 through 22. And you could label it this, the hope of redemption. The hope of redemption. Verse 13 says, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and Boaz gave her conception. Did you see that? No, that's not what it says. We're really going to see who opens their Bible. No, that's not what it said. Boaz gave her conception, right? I mean, because he's the Redeemer. He married her. No, it says right here in verse 13, and Boaz went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. This author, all of Israel know the story of Ruth. It was God who gave her this child. It was God's work. It wasn't just fortune. It wasn't just luck. It wasn't just that her body had somehow changed in the famine to now flourishing. It was God who gave her miraculously conception to have a child. In verse 14, the redemption continues. Then the women, which I said at the beginning, remember, listen to the women. You have to listen to the women in this story. They're a major character. They go all the way back to chapter 1, talking to Naomi, and they come back right here. Then the women of Bethlehem, said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you, Naomi, the mother-in-law, who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. See, this is so interesting. Because you and I are thinking the whole time, Boaz is the redeemer, right? You've got the first redeemer who says no, and he abdicates this right to redeem Ruth. And then we move to the main redeemer, right? The one that we love in the story, Boaz. And they start talking about a third redeemer here, the women of Bethlehem. They're saying, your son Obed, your grandson actually, is Naomi's redeemer. And what they mean is that this son is God's redemption. He is truly a redeemer. He has brought your family line that was dead, your land that was as good as gone, back to life. And Obed is the one who did that. Now, did he do that? It was God's hand. But Obed was the one. He was this promised child that fulfilled, that made Naomi's life full. Look at verse 16. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Ruth. No, right? I love that. I love that some of you actually shook your heads. No, that's not what the text says. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. This story from Ruth, it's a story of Naomi's redemption. Ruth's a perfect character. She just always does what's right. That's all that we hear. She wasn't perfect. She was a sinner. She experienced God's grace, like so many Christians. But it's Naomi that we get to hear the darkness of her heart, that I'm empty. God's against me. But we see the reversal of her story, the redemption of her story, and the change of her heart. And then we land on this final note of redemption. We land on David. Even again, the narrator brings us back. Not only does Obed, Father Jesse, the father of David, but then he goes back a little bit further and shares a little more of the genealogy from Perez to David. Perez, the son of Judah. Which gives us this note of there's redemption to come. You see, one of my biggest questions, and this is, oh man, this is a sidetrack. When was Ruth actually written? Like, when did it happen? It happened during the period of the Judges. But it was obviously written and recorded during the time of David. Because David's mentioned twice here. And it wasn't just an add-on, like the story played out, and so they added in the genealogy. No, very pointed. What this author is saying is that there has been redemption woven into the DNA of God's people. And so we don't know exactly when, and a lot of people guess it's when this text is written, but we know what the purpose of this text is. To give God's people hope. That better times are coming. And so as we land on David, this great king who God made great promises to, it was the most prosperous time in Israel. On into David's son Solomon when he reigned. That's what it's sharing right here, that in redemption, better things are ahead. So Naomi, when she's hopeless, that things can be turned around. You see, the women, listen to the women of the town. They tie this story together. In chapter 1, Naomi testified to the women of Bethlehem, God is against me. I'm empty-handed. I'm coming back. Don't call me Naomi. I'm not pleasant anymore. I'm bitter. But in the end here, her hands are full of Obed, the grandson, who has brought her family back to life. And the women of Bethlehem come around and they take note and they talk to Naomi and they actually name him Obed because they realize that this child of redemption is a much bigger picture to them than just to Naomi. That's how big this story is, and they knew it back then. Her hands are full. She said they were empty. And right here we have a picture of her hands being full with this child who was given to her by God as his redemption. The women testify about Naomi. That even when she complained her hands were empty, God was working her redemption to fill her hands up again. And the women share that with us. The picture of the women, contrasted from chapter 1, show us that. And here's the point. This is God's redeeming love for us. At the height of our complaint or our ignorance or our rebellion against God or our rejection of him, Jesus, God plans and sends his son to redeem us. Literally to buy us back from our slavery to sin, to free us. Naomi's redeemer is a grandson, a gift from God in this little town of Bethlehem. The people of Israel saw David, this great king, as a gift from God, but there was another child that they waited longer for. It's the one that Matthew connects to Ruth and to Obed. In Matthew 1:21, it's Jesus, the Christ, the Son of God. Matthew says, "She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins." And save is another way of saying redeem, to bring them back to God, to restore them, to take them from death to life with God, to bring the people that were once dead to God back into a relationship with him. So there are two ways we should apply that. Two ways we should apply this. That Jesus is working redemption to bring people back to God. Number one is this: don't ignore Jesus' life-giving redemption. Do not ignore Jesus' life-giving redemption. A lot of times we have this sneaking suspicion that we're like Naomi. I mean, some other people can have hope, and Christianity works for some people, but it does not work for me. God's grace doesn't apply in the same way to me as it does to other people. We can believe that. Maybe it's because we're cynical that God's power can actually change our hearts. Maybe we're confused that redemption's going to mean health, wealth, the greatest relationships, comfort. And so we're bitter when those things don't come because we've confused redemption with our circumstances, with temporal happiness. This is what God would say to us through Ruth. When we have that sneaking suspicion that we should be hopeless like Naomi, don't be. We need to fix our eyes on Jesus. We need to turn to him and be filled up with hope because he gives life. He makes full in the kind of fullness that can't be taken away from us, giving us life with God. Here's what he's doing, though. He's saying, don't ignore that my redemption, my greatest gift to you, brother and sister, is that I sent my son to die for you. Don't ignore his work of redemption. He lived the perfect life. He gave himself on the cross in order to bring you back to me. And Jesus rose from the grave to show us that he is living that life. Like, he's not still dead. He's not still paying that price. No, his resurrection is both the power and the picture that we get life with God. Don't ignore the life-giving redemption in Jesus. And secondly, this, about God's work of redemption, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come. As a Christian, I can identify with this, and maybe you can too, brothers and sisters. A lot of times, even walking with Jesus, we have some really pessimistic thoughts, negative emotions and feelings. Like we just can't snap out of them. And we want to. We don't want to be there. We don't want to have these meltdowns or these destructive patterns of thinking. But like Naomi, we feel like our hands are empty and they're tied. There's no changing. There's no redemption. And I want to tell you that the feeling of emptiness is actually good tuition as a Christian. You see, separation from God is emptiness. Adam and Eve were kicked out of the fullness of God's presence, and there was an empty feeling in their stomach. And even more than that, they were kicked out of this perfect garden, the fruitfulness that was there. That's a consequence of the fall. Our intuition to feel that emptiness because of sin is right. It's not wrong. Don't mask over that. Don't glance over that. But perhaps like Naomi, your marriage, your job, adult life, your financial plan, it isn't as full or fulfilling, right, as you'd hoped that it would be. Here's the hope. It's the thought of our Redeemer. It's his pattern of thinking. That's what we need. If Jesus can endure the painful cross, carrying our sin on him, the punishment of God, and do it with the motivation of joy, one of the most painful sufferings of God's wrath, then you and I need to keep our chin up and our eyes fixed on Jesus when we walk through pain and suffering. When our life doesn't turn out the way that we think, just like Naomi's life didn't turn out the way that she thought as she walks back into Bethlehem, ashamed to share the story of losing her husband and her two sons. Hebrews 12, 1 through 2 says this: therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Verse 2, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame. And now is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. You see, when sin has us behind its cruel whip, and we feel like we're conformed to its image, or else we will suffer punishment, controlled by our own sinful desires, we feel terrible. We're disgusted by our own actions, and we say, we'll never change. But here's what we need to believe. God is working redemption in Jesus. And even though there's one area of your life where you say, I do not look like Jesus, it is empty of Jesus, here's the hope that we have. That the good news of Jesus' life and cross and empty tomb are God's redemptive power. There's no trick, there's no tip, there's no magic, there's no secret sauce. It's the cross. That what Jesus did is enough to redeem and therefore sanctify and change us and give us life with God where we're not experiencing life with God. Matthew 10:45 says this, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." And maybe you've seen some redeemers, some saviors, some heroes, and you felt like they're not really interested in helping me. I don't think they really care about me. I don't think anybody wants to roll up their sleeves, get down on their knees, help me deal with the muck of my life. And so we feel hopeless. But none of us can rightly look at Jesus' story, who came to give his life as a ransom for you, can look at our Savior and say, I don't think he was interested in caring about me. Jesus gave himself completely on the cross that you and I would experience the fullness of redemption. One degree of glory, looking more and more like Jesus until glorification. When we look like him, his virtues, his character completely, one day in heaven. Why? Because Jesus fills us. His redemption fills us with hope that the best is yet to come. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you that your redemption means that no part of our life is beyond hope. That some in here want their life status to change. We want our negative patterns of thinking to change. And because of Jesus' redemption, they can and they will. So God, we praise you for your redemption in your Son. That you didn't leave us hopeless. You didn't leave us as orphans. You didn't leave us, your church, empty. But you are filling us up with your Spirit all the time. God, open our eyes that we cannot ignore Jesus' redemption. And fill us with the hope that the greatest parts of our life with you are yet to come. It's in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen.